Hey, everybody. Welcome to Rock and Roll Shinsu Chu. Tonight's episode is a field guide to 1975. In 1975, America's two greatest pastimes, baseball and popular music, of course, gave us thrills, chills, mustaches, and more. From the most memorable Game 6 in World Series history to landmark albums from Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Bruce Springsteen, and Patti Smith, everyone was firing on all cylinders at the midpoint of the me decade. And what a year. Listen as we highlight memorable milestones in baseball and share several of our favorite records from the year of the rabbit. Welcome to the machine, the big red machine, that is. This is Rock and Roll Shinsu Chu, episode number 124, a field guide to 1975. My name is Gabe Estel, and I'm here with my co-hosts Dennis Levi Leach and Jonathan Getz. It's been too long. How are you guys?
Good.
Feeling good.
Excellent. Glad to be here. Glad to be back in the saddle. And I hope in 2026, it'll be the year of the chew, if 1975 was the year of the rabbit. So we'll try to up our output here. But thanks for everybody hanging with us. Well, we're going to go ahead with our two halves. We're going to start with baseball. A very memorable year in baseball. Dare I say one of the years where the losing team of the World Series has the more memorable moment than the team that won the World Series, right? Do you guys, yeah?
Wait, the Red Sox didn't win that World Series? What?
Exactly. I got to admit, like, I knew the Reds won a couple World Series and, you know, they were, yeah. I'll get into like the win losses a little bit, but you know, the team of the decade, the Reds, I think, you know, they got the most wins. But they won the World Series in 75. And from my childhood, not my childhood, but at least the highlights that I watched and all the, you know, all the lore that's built up around it over the years, I think of the 1975 World Series, I just think of Carlton Fisk going like that, right? like right? Pointing, right? Yeah, right? That's what I think of. I don't always think about, yeah, like, it's kind of the start of, well, the Reds have been competitive for a few years. It's one of their first two championships. But more known.
Yeah,
the
they
Red
thought
Sox.
That they would never, they were worried they wouldn't, weren't going to win one, that they were just going to be this regular season champion forever, and that they wouldn't actually be able to punch their ticket with the World Series trophy.
Right. Yeah. It's like an all-star team, the Reds that year. You know, I mean, it's stacked. We did an episode on 1976, I remember. So we, you know, we covered some ground with this Reds team, and I think it's largely the same players from 75 and 76. But you know, you go down the list and it's just stacked, you know.
Yeah.
You've of course got Pete Rose,
Joe Morgan.
Joe Morgan, Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Concepcion, Tony Perez, you've got Jimenez, right?
And Foster, a young George Foster.
Yeah.
Ken Griffey Sr.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And their starting pitching was just like kind of okay.
Yeah.
It was really that lineup that
did it.
That clinched it for him, yeah. Four gold glove winners, too.
Right. There's with Bench and Morgan, two Hall of Famers.
And Pete Rose, asterisk. You
know. Yeah. Put him in. That's for another episode, but put him in.
Joe Morgan won the MVP that year. Bench finished fourth, and Rose finished fifth.
Damn. You got three of the top, three of your guys in the top five in MVP voting.
Yeah.
You're probably gonna win the World Series. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that about the pitching for the Reds that year. You know, like pretty much every starter just about had double digit wins, but there's not really like between these two teams, there's not really like a Hall of Fame pitcher. You know what I mean, on either team, right? I'm missing somebody from the Red Sox. I know Tiant, right, was the guy that year for them.
Louis Tiant had a bit of a renaissance that year. Yeah. But And it was funny because he, you know, he had peaked a few years earlier, and then he had a couple down years, and the Reds like didn't respect him. I watched one documentary, and Tion won both. I think he won both of his starts in the World Series. And the Reds, when they talk about it, like, man, he wasn't any good. We had his number. We should have beat him. And it's like, well, you didn't twice. I mean, don't get me wrong. You had the last laugh, but don't be like,
I think he started three games, dude, in the World Series.
Was it three? Wow. Oh, that's right. Because of the thanks to the rain delay,
four day rain delay. There were like a 4 day rain delay. Yeah. So the anticipation for this World Series, game six, anticipation was high, and it certainly delivered.
Yeah, absolutely. And Louis Tion's father was able to fly in for the first time to see him pitch in the States.
Yeah, he's from Cuba.
In the World Series. Yeah, from Cuba, which was that's pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that 4 day rain delay was apparently because of a nor'easter. I can't imagine just the buildup for freaking days.
Sure.
The Red Sox were without Jim Rice for the playoffs that year, because both Fred Lynn and Jim Rice were their star rookies, and Rice was injured just before the playoffs started.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. I mean, I know he had a monster rookie year. Him and Lynn both. Lynn got MVP, right?
He did, yeah. Rookie of the year and MVP first.
Rookie of the year and MVP.
First player to earn both honors. Yeah.
And Fred Lynn not in the Hall of Fame, right? To my knowledge.
Correct. I was curious. I was like, is he? Is he not? He's like an 80% Hall of Famer. He's like 80% of the way there. If you look at like all the numbers and the comparisons, and he's kind of an 80% guy.
Okay. I knew he was at least Hall of Pretty Good, or even maybe Hall of Really Good. And then, you know, I'm looking at the Reds rotation. You know, obviously, like, six guys with double-digit wins. So, obviously, that's, you know, they've got a lot of offense to power those wins. Gary Nolan, Jack Dillingham, Fred Norman, Don Gullett's probably their best pitcher. I would say, like, I think he was kind of the ace that year.
Yeah,
if they had one
by ERA,
highest war. And Gullett, actually, you know, another guy I didn't know much about. He only pitched in the 70s, so he came in the league at 19 in 70, which the Reds were, as you mentioned earlier, very good in the early 70s before they won these couple titles too. They were always kind of a bridesmaid, so to speak. And then he's out of the league by the time he's 27. But, you know, he, for a short window, small sample size, this Gullet, 109 wins, 50 losses. It's pretty good.
Yeah, that's a solid career.
Yeah. Over 266 games, a 3.11 ERA.
So there's a lot of guys that
I just didn't know, you know. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. They're guys, they only had a couple guys eclipse 200 innings, which at the time, like, a lot of pitchers would eclipse 200 innings. I mean, the Red Sox, their top three pitchers each eclipsed 250 innings, including Bill Spaceman Lee, who's one of the great characters of baseball.
Right.
But yeah, the Red Sox had the advantage. It seemed like it in the with the rotation. But yeah, I mean, against the Big Red Machine, what can you do?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They were just plowing people down. They
were like the Yankee dynasty before the Yankee. Yankee dynasty of the 90s, that was basically the Reds and the 70s.
Right.
Yeah, you would think a lot of people grew to hate them just because they were always hanging around. They did supplant the A's, though, because, yeah, that decade had that decade had three teams win multiple World Series.
Yeah. I mean, it was the three teams dominated the decade. There were, yeah. I mean, there were teams that were competitive. Like the Yankees were pretty competitive. The Royals were, Yankees got one series, you know, and obviously big Reggie's year at 77. And then, you know, the Royals were pretty good in the late 70s too with division titles. But yeah, I mean, that decade, there was only one year. Or no, wait, I'm sorry. Seven. Okay. They won 7 of 10 titles in that decade between the three of them.
The Reds, Pirates, and A's.
Excuse me. Yeah. The A's dominated the early part of the decade. The Reds, the mid part of the decade. Pirates were competitive really throughout the whole decade, just like the Reds. I mean, you mentioned the National League in the 70s, and it's just two teams just totally dominate. You know, the Reds and the Pirates. Dodgers had some good teams too. But like nothing close to, you know, how strong.
Say it again, Reds, Pirates, and A's.
Yeah. Those are the, so
there will never ever be those small market teams that like have a corner on the dynasties. That's wild.
Yeah. You look at, basically all three of those teams from like, let's look at them the last 30 years.
Right.
You know? Yeah. There's probably
did
seven.
They like sell their soul for the devil in the 70s or something.
Yeah.
Imagine explaining to your kid about the World Series winners of the 1970s.
Right. The Reds, the Pirates, and the A's. Yeah. So the Reds have the most wins of the decade. They have 953 wins. Two World Series titles and seven division titles. The Pirates are in second with 893 wins, two World Series titles and six division titles. And then the A's in a third with 855 wins, three World Series titles and five division titles. So the A's drop off after basically this season, after 75. Maybe 75 or 76, they drop off. So, like, they really just dominate the first half of the decade. And then, you know, it becomes, like I said, you have a few teams that, you know, the Orioles were pretty good in the early 70s, never quite got the title, but they were always in the playoffs. Royals in the late 70s. Yankees kind of a few, you know, sprinkled throughout the decade. Dodgers, same thing. But yeah, it was just these three teams. It was all these three. Dominant.
The Red Sox that year, of course, famously they were wearing their red hats.
Yes,
and this is important for me to note that the Red Sox wore those red hats only from 74 to 78 as their regular hats.
Mm-hmm.
I thought was interesting that was all it lasted. Quick correction, the Orioles did win the World Series in 1970.
Oh, okay, they were the first one. Yeah. Okay, all right, yeah. Start of the decade. Brooks Robinson, height of his career, I would imagine.
And again, try imagine explaining that to your kid that the Orioles, man, they won a couple World Series in 5 years.
you mentioned the hats of the Red Sox that year. I like those red hats. I think I actually got
good.
Those a long time.
You got one for me.
It was a golden era of uniforms. Yeah. You know, this is the stuff that Super 70s, you know, this is what you think of when you think of uniforms, or Frederick. You know, because like this was the era where teams were starting to wear the same color of pants as they would the tops. You know, like the Orioles had like an all orange. Cleveland had like an all red.
The pajamas,
right? And then the baby blues, the powder blues, started around this time. You know, the Phillies wearing those, and some other teams. So yeah, it was a very colorful era of uniforms, and also, you know, baseball. Even though like the country was changing a lot in the late 60s and early 70s, like mid 70s is kind of like when baseball players kind of, so to speak, let their hair down. You know what I mean? This is when you see more mustaches and long hair and afros, and you know, it's This is when it really, 75 or so is when it really starts to look like the 70s at baseball.
Right. Yeah, I mean, even during, you know, the height of counterculture in the late 60s, like, it hadn't trickled down yet to the players.
Right, yeah. The sports sports is always, you know, was always a little more clean cut. You know what I mean?
Sure. Sort of, yeah, definitely.
But it's cool. Like, now, you know, you got more colorful guys expressing themselves, more colorful personalities, and also, you know, changes on kind of the baseball labor front with the advent of free agency. That's when this this offseason with, I think it was Andy Messersmith was the guy, first guy. I think, I believe he was baseball's first free agent when he was pitching for the Dodgers. Okay. Another guy other than, like, he's kind of a trivia question, you know, because of that. Another guy that put together a pretty solid career as a pitcher, too, kind of short, you know, like 12 seasons. But he finished in the top five in Cy Young three times, Andy Messersmith. Mostly with the Dodgers, and then he was on the Angels, too. But, yeah, really solid pitcher. But he was the guy that really, you know, did a good thing, ultimately, you know, for the players, and was able to, you know, test the waters of free agency, and then that expanded to really the rest of the league.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So the that famous shot of Carlton Fisk in Game Six, hitting the home run in the 12th inning. I think it was the 12th inning.
Yeah,
we kind of take it for granted that, like, oh, there's going to be every angle you want is available for the World Series, right? And of course, this being the 70s, well, that wasn't the case. Baseball on television was still kind of coming into its own.
Yeah.
And that shot of Fisk was mostly thanks to the Green Monster, where they had a camera out in the Green Monster. And that they were shooting through, you know, one of the holes in the Green Monster. So the cameraman was inside the Green Monster shooting through one of those pockets. And his director was talking to him on his headset, apparently. It was like, hey, you know, if Fisk gets a hold of one here, try to follow the ball, you know, over up against the wall. And the cameraman's like, dude, if I turn the camera, like, at this angle, like, I've got stuff in front of me. I can't see it. And he's like, he's like, I'm just going to stay on Fisk. I'm just going to stick on Fisk and see what happens. And that is the reason that we have a shot of Carlton Fisk waving the ball fair at all. Like, there's a really good chance that shot doesn't, like, we don't ever see that if it's different guy or a different director in the booth. And so, yeah, we shouldn't take it for granted.
Absolutely. Special game. I mean, I mean, obviously, I guess we could argue greatest World Series of all time. And, you know, there's been quite a few of them that have gone to seven games. And obviously that, you know, usually makes it pretty good. But this is definitely the best Game Six of all time, I would say.
Right? It is so remarkable that the Reds were able to come back from it, not only from losing that dramatic Game Six, because Game Seven, of course, was in Fenway as well.
Right.
But they were down 3-0 early in Game Seven. The Reds were, because the Red Sox hit a 3-run dinger, I think. And they still came back and won it. It was like, oh my gosh. It was like the World Series we just had, where you kept expecting the home team to pull it out, but they just didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. 1975 to 76, you know, a good time for Cincinnati, right? I mean, you know, that's kind of that city's, that late 70s is kind of that city's moment in the sun, you know, with the TV show coming up, right? Just a couple of years later, I think the TV show debuted in like 78, 77 or 78, something like that.
As a child, I was ready to move there. Every woman looked like Lonnie Anderson and Bailey. Yeah. I was kind of a Bailey guy. Lonnie was too, but give me some Bailey.
Yeah. Yeah, man, it's cool that a smaller city was kind of on the map like that.
Right? You know, it seems crazy.
The Bengals went 11-3 that year.
Okay. Yeah. You know, we'll talk briefly. You know, we're all, obviously, we've got our teams. Levi, not a great decade for Chicago baseball, the 70s.
No,
right?
No, the 70s yeah. were terrible. And yeah, I'll do my little crash course on the state of 1975 Cubs. You know, when you talk about the 1975 Cubs, you talk about a team that was caught up in like a strange middle ground, like a fading glow of the late 60s core on one side and a future that wasn't quite formed yet on the other side. And Wrigley Field, remember, at this time still had no lights, not for another 13 years would they come. So the bleachers were still cheap, the organ echoed all around the ballpark, and the Cubs were still owned by someone named Wrigley. It felt like baseball preserved in kind of a museum case. And so the Cubs finished the year 75-87, which was good for fifth place in the National League. Not terrible, but not competitive. The kind of record that pretty much defined the mid-70s Cubs.
It seems like last place teams of today have a lot fewer wins. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right? For sure. Mm-hmm. You know, they scored 673 runs, allowed 735, which means, you know, they could hit, but the pitching couldn't hold up.
Right.
You know, it was the last season for Billy Williams in a Cubs uniform, 1975. And even at 37, he hit .280 with 16 homers. Still with his effortless smooth swing. His final hit as a Cub was a home run, too. So that's a good way to go out.
Nice.
One of the bright spots of the year, though, for the Cubs was Bill Madlock, who incredibly hit .354 and won the National League batting title. It was the Cubs' first batting champion since 1945. In an era dominated by pitching and artificial turf, hitting .354 pretty much jumps off the page. You know, he was, because of the title, the Cubs eventually traded him the next year for Bobby Mercer. Mm-hmm. And I'll go into that a little bit because you touched on free agency. And so Bill Madlock is basically the Cubs' first, you know, victim of free agency. The Wrigleys were like, it's absurd to pay someone $200,000, which supposedly he wanted 3 years, $200,000. He wanted $600K. And the Cubs were like, that's insane. No. And so we got basically nothing for him, kind of. And then just a couple years later, they paid Dave Kingman like a contract that came to like $275 a year. So it's kind of crazy they weren't willing to pay him. A lot of Cubs fans of that era are still pretty sore about it.
Yeah.
The Cubs also had Jose Cardinal, who quietly put together kind of like a really good all-around season on the team. He hit .317. He had 30 steals. He played awesome, strong defense. He had tons of personality. He was always like a fan favorite guy on the team of that era. And pitching wise,
that was always Eddie Vedder's favorite. From the era, it was Jose Cardinal. Yeah.
Pitching wise, you know, the staff was like Steve Stone, Bill Bottom, Paul Rushell, and then the only kind of bright spot was Rick Rushell, who was 14-12 with a 3.11 ERA that year. And so, yeah, I mean, they weren't a contender, but, I mean, they were memorable a little bit. Like, it was like a mix of personalities. They were trying to put together, like, a group of personalities, like one of those 70s teams, but they just couldn't really make it click. There was no glue. And so, yeah, more of the same with the 75 Cubs.
Yeah, I mean, to hop across town, Levi, the Sox have a similar record. I think you won two more games than we did, you know, something like that. Yeah. But Jonathan had pointed this out when we were talking, prepping for this episode, just exchanging texts. The 1975 White Sox have, I'll say, three guys that are well-known players, two of them Hall of Famers, one of them probably Hall of Pretty Good, that are not commonly associated with the White Sox, right? One is the pitcher Jim Catt, okay? Hall of Famer, right? You know, most people think of him on the Twins. He was 36 when he's pitching for the Sox in 75 and put up a good year. You know, still he was late in his career, but he finished fourth in the Cy Young that year. You know, won 20 games, gave up a lot of hits, led the league in most hits given up, but still, you know, still a lot of gas left in the tank for that guy. And did you guys know Jim Capp played 25 seasons?
Wow.
Jeez.
No.
Wow.
Jim Capp's first year in baseball was in 1959. He retired in 1983. Yeah.
Awesome.
1983. He wrapped up his career with the Cardinals. He was on the Cardinals for like the last 4 years. Okay, so a couple others, right? Rich Gossage was the White Sox closer that year. Young Rich Gossage, it's like his third or fourth year in the league. He's 23, and obviously he goes on to, you know, a Hall of Fame career with other teams. He was our closer that year, and arguably he finished sixth in Cy Young and was, you know, for a middling team, one of the American League's best relief pitchers. He had a 1.84 ERA. And led the league with 26 saves. So good season there for young Rich. And then also a couple other guys that stand out to me one guy that stands out to me that I don't commonly associate with the White Sox. Bucky Dent was on that team that year too.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Who would get the World Series MVP, right, with the Yankees Bucky 2 years
Dent.
Later, I think.
Bucky fucking Dent. Bucky fucking Dent.
Yeah. Yeah. Bucky. Fucking Dent. I don't know. He played for the Sox for, I think of him more on Detroit, but we still had Chet Lemon at that time. Who would have a Hall of pretty good career, you know, most of it spent in Detroit. But yeah, so those three guys, right? Like, I mean, all pretty famous players. Two Hall of Famers, you know, a World Series MVP on the White Sox that year. So,
wow. Yeah, it's wild too, because the White Sox also had predominantly red hats that year, right?
They did. Yeah.
So the both the White Sox and the Red Sox had these decided we're both going red hats this year.
And the White Sox rotation with the powder blue was brief, but we did have it in that era. We did have it powder like blue? 72, 73, 74. Yeah. Wow.
We need to get you a red satin starter Sox jacket.
Man. I know.
That would be sick.
I have thought about it. Like, if I want more jersey t-shirts, and MLB won't do it. They just want you to buy the full jerseys. I want like jersey t-shirts of older players, you know, like I love a Dick Allen, like, you know, jersey t-shirt or something.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, yeah, kind of a mediocre year definitely a mediocre year in Chicago. The Royals gets, like, kind of on the, like, I don't know what their record was in 75. I'll look it up. But, like, the Royals obviously would start to get good. Yeah. I mean, George Brett is on his ascendancy, right? I mean,
John Mayberry that year finished second in the MVP voting. He was Royals' first baseman.
Right.
34 dingers, 106 RBI, 168 OPS plus. And it was the peak of John Mayberry. That's for certain. But yeah, 22-year-old George Brett on that team, 195 hits that year, 13 triples, already getting some MVP votes as well. These guys would form, would be a big part of their success later in the decade.
They're laying the groundwork for something good, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Steve Busby, Alphonse Morris, Dennis Leonard, Paul Splittorff. Yeah, those dudes. Yeah, those dudes were slinging it.
Was McCray playing for him then? Not yet, right?
Oh, Hal McCray. Yeah, he was. Okay. Yeah, 29 years old, and he was an All Star that year. Actually, the only positional player All-Star, Steve Busby, was also an All-Star that year. The Royals were starting to get it going that year. They did finish 91-71, and so really solid season. Ultimately finished behind the Angels. Who did they finish behind?
In 75 would have been the A's, right?
Or the A's. I'm sorry. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the A's were still tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though the A's got swept by the Red Sox. So, yeah, that was the other interesting thing I thought was that both the NLCS and ALCS were sweeps.
Yeah.
So, very uninteresting, only to then have a 7-game World Series. So, baseball kind of, you know, it gives and it takes.
Yeah. It's kind of the end of the 70s A's, you know, because they lost Catfish Hunter, still fielded a really competitive team, but
98 wins, yeah, dude.
It slipped away after that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Catfish Hunter, he's like the original Bobby Bowe, man. He was one of the first guys to ever do the deferred contract.
Yes.
Ah, there you go. Yeah.
Yep.
One last note that I had. Bill Matlock, the Cubs player, Levi, you were talking about. He grew up in Decatur, Illinois.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
He had 500 hits for the Cubs and 1,500 hits after they let him go.
Yeah, no, the Cubs were morons, clearly.
That's tough.
God bless them.
Yeah.
Well, I'll always root for a Central Illinois guy, fellas. You know, it doesn't matter if it's Bill Matlock or Kevin Cronin. You know, yeah, I'll always root for a Central Illinois guy. So it was a very memorable year for baseball, Big Red Machine. Let's switch it up. Let's go Welcome to the Machine for 1975, a year in music. You know, I think, guys, we ran into the same problem. So we've done these field guides, which are a lot of fun, where we look at the year in baseball and the year in popular music. And the only other 70s year we did was we did 76 a few years back. And we ran into the same problem. There was like too many albums to talk about, right? Just because the 70s is so rich with great music. I think just... You know, so many things are subjective and subject to individual taste, but I think it's pretty much inarguable that the 70s are the best decade of music, right? I mean, it's of American popular music. It has to be.
Like pound for pound, probably. Yeah. Like album for album.
Are you making me pick a decade that like
you can only listen to this decade for the rest of your life?
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, to me, it's not even
like
tough.
In my mind, if I try to make it by a scientific basis of the qualifications, if you look at the 70s across all the genres, like I think there may be the most solid even is the 70s, whether it's like pop, rock, metal, dance. Like
country,
I think 70 is pretty solid even along the way.
Levi, like you mentioned, I think because of just the strength of every genre, you know, right. What I mean, yeah. Like it's all represented here. I mean, I've always been, you know, ever since I was a kid, fascinated by the 70s. You know, if a song was recorded during that decade, even if it's on like a mediocre album, I'll still find something I probably like about it just because I like the production so much. I like the era so much. You know what I mean? Like I will listen to any album from the 70s and probably not hate it because just their strengths just across genres. And kind of like a little bit of historical context of where we are in 1975, right? America's coming off, Vietnam, you know, right, is wrapped up at this point, and everybody's kind of deflated about it. You know, it was not exactly a World War II moment or anything for the United States, right? And then also you got Watergate, happening the year before, and also the economy is in pretty rough shape in 75. The stagflation, right, is occurring. So it's kind of like a time of sort of. From what I gather, right, everybody's kind of cynical, come 75, right? Like, the 60s are definitely over. But for music, I mean, it's all happening, you know?
For sure.
There's so much you could do, and so much record companies were putting so much weight behind experimental music. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I mean, that's the beauty of the decade to me, is that people were really rewarded for creativity. And people really, record companies, right, like, really took a chance on artists and put, like, if you had success, put a lot of weight on, you know, behind them. Like, fuck, hey, let me, case in point, the guys in Yes all got to release solo albums under a big label, and, you know, right?
Right. Well, yeah, and I mean, that's, I'll talk about, if you don't mind, it's like a
perfect segue. Yeah, go for it. Let it rip. Yeah.
A perfect segue to one of the albums I was going to touch on. With two things, is this has an Illinois connection, and Yes. So, you know, in 1975, if you wanted a great example of how deep the Midwest progressive rock scene was, you didn't do much better than Starcastle, the pride of Champaign, Illinois. Their 1975 self-titled debut is a fascinating snapshot of American prog trying to keep pace with the giants overseas, especially Yes. And let's be honest, the Yes comparisons are unavoidable. Soaring tenor vocals, bright Rickenbacker bass tone, stacked harmonies, the whole deal. But what makes Starcastle stand out is the precision. These weren't studio experiments. These were tight, gig-tested musicians who had worked their way up through the Illinois bar and college circuit scene. The album opens with Lady of the Lake, which is an 8-minute prog suite that still stands as probably their signature track. It's full of tempo shifts, spiraling synth lines, like instantly recognizable vocals by Terry Luttrell, who, fun fact, had been the original singer for REO Speedwagon. So the Illinois rock family tree, you know, it's got lots of branches. Like, the thing that I notice about when listening to this Starcastle album is, compared to some of the prog scene of the time, which was like heavier and darker, Starcastle always had like an optimistic, shimmering kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I don't know if either of you guys were going to mention that album, but like the Angel self-titled album, I would put that vibe alongside this same type of like optimistic prog kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they got on Billboard charts and toured for a while, but like, honestly, didn't last forever. But the debut massive album is fantastic, and people all over Central Illinois still talk and know about Starcastle.
Yeah, well put. How about this, guys? Let's do this for a second, right? Because, you know, our albums kind of span different genres. Let's continue the prog thing for just this beginning here, because
I have two more that follow that. Yeah,
it is kind of the most fashionable thing in rock and roll at that time, right? I mean, like, prog is still
selling, so the record companies, like you said, record companies are willing to put money behind a band that kind of sounds like Yes.
Yeah, you know, like, you're like, hey, you got 15 minute song, sure, you know, here's we're RCA Records, go make a bunch of, you know, yeah, we'll give you a bunch of money to make. So it's crazy, you know, and I mean, it's great. I love all that stuff, as indulgent as some of it might be. But you know, this is kind of still prog is still on top. You know, it would kind of probably start to wane a little bit in the next couple of years, but it's still on top. And Levi, you had mentioned with Starcastle, you know, they're American, right? And you know, we think of prog's origins as very British, I think.
Starcastle. And if it was coming from USA, you would not think it would be the cornfields of Illinois.
Yeah.
No. You would think American prog, maybe San Fran or New York. Like, but no, they were, that's the part that kind of, I think, blows my mind.
Well, you had a lot of younger kids influenced by Yes. Yep. You know, I think you saw some of that a little bit later in the decade too, with what I would call almost like American kind of pop prog, like Kansas had that, Styx had that, a little bit later, a year or two later, Boston had that, right? Journey, at least their early stuff. And then, you know, obviously they make it slicker when Perry arrives. But yeah, you know, Starcastle had some of that too. That kind of it's American prog, you know.
Right.
Yeah, a little bit brighter, a little bit tighter on you know the production and everything. But yeah, that's good stuff.
And so like one of the other albums I was going to talk about that kind of. The two others that kind of lean prog, and it goes to show, like you said, prog was big, and it was what seemed to be making money, and so radio program directors are going to play it, and then that helps push it even more. And so one of the next albums that really, really, really got pushed by radio from 1975 is Gary Wright's The Dreamweaver.
Hmm.
And so... you could say, like, if any album from 1975 changed the sound of radio, it was The Dreamweaver. And not just because of, like, the songwriting, though the songs, like, still kind of hold up. But it's because of the instrumentation. It was literally the first album on the radio that was... it's all synth. It's all keys. It's all electronic textures. There's no groove at all on the record. And in 1975, that was pretty wild. Like, it was a pretty radical idea to have a guy, you know, with huge singles and it's all keyboards. And so the title track, Dreamweaver, was a monster hit in 76, but the album dropped in late 75. And, you know, has Mini Moog, ARP, all the prog instrumentation all over it. And he just kind of was able to turn it into, like, prog pop rock just as the time of like FM radio and all of that, and so it worked out perfectly. His background, he was the former keyboardist for Spooky Tooth. I don't know if you guys knew that. Love Is Alive is my favorite song off of it, and arguably it's even better than Dreamweaver. The bass synth line is like a blueprint for what 80s synth pop would later kind of become.
Spooky Tooth, he's British, right? Then Wright's
yeah,
British.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. The whole record has this like warm, almost cosmic meditative feel that like helps set it apart from other 70s records. I don't know how to explain it. It has like an earthy, proggy synth vibe to the whole thing. And I mean, he did have a spiritual streak because he had been influenced by Indian philosophy from touring and playing keys for George Harrison. And so you can kind of feel the calm and floating vibe throughout the whole record. And that album kind of helped push us into like an electronic music age.
Yeah.
Gary Wright.
And I'm glad you mentioned him too, Levi, because I had always forgotten. I knew that guy had like a good resume, you know, like I knew like I didn't know all of his stops, so to speak, along the way. But he was a talented dude.
Love Is Alive is one of those songs, if it's ever on the radio, I'm like, banger, turn it up.
Well, you guys know, I mean, I could talk about prog shit all day.
Right? We can.
But the one thing I will mention of my prog choice for my album, and then Jonathan, I'll kick it over to you. Yeah. But I chose Chris Squire's Fish Out of Water. I think this is, as I mentioned, you know, prog is so huge that everybody in Yes gets a solo album, right? You know, it's part of the deal. They're huge. Like, I mean, Yes can totally kind of shit where they want to in 1975. You know, when you're playing stadiums, and you can do that, I guess. But yeah, so, you know, Alan White, you know, Patrick Mraz, Hal Anderson, and Squire. And I think and I've listened to all of them, I think by Squire's is like far and away the best. It's the Ace Frehley of solo albums of the bunch, right? he was always... you know, he was the guy up until more recently and kind of what Yes has become. He was the guy that was always on every Yes record. So I always felt like the Fish was kind of the engine, you know, behind Yes. He's a hell of a bass player. He's, you know, him and Entwistle have always been my favorites. But I really like that album, Fish Out of Water a lot. It's only five tunes, so it's definitely the songs are, except for a couple, kind of Yes length. But it opens with a really, really good song that I assume was the single, Hold Out Your Hand, which is a really tight song. You know, it's almost like, it kind of maybe like, I'm surprised it wasn't maybe a little bit of a bigger single along the lines of like some of Yes's, you know, kind of singles of the 70s. And then it just, there another song short, and then it ends just really beautifully with Safe, Cannon Song, at the end of it. And he's you know, he's a great composer as well. So he's one of those guys that just, you know, he plays the bass like it plays, like you play a guitar. You know what I mean? I mean, the fish is the man, as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, that's what I wanted to highlight, because it's I think that album I even like more than like Yes's later 70s work. I think it's better than any Yes album after Close to the Edge. You know what I mean? Like starting from like Tales from Topographic Oceans and Relayer and Tremato and whatever other was Going for the One. I think it's better than all those. So I think it's just as, I think it's as good as, you know, half of Yes's output from the 70s. The Fish, RIP. Love that guy.
Yeah.
Should we name some of these obvious albums that came out? Like the sure. albums that
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, go for it.
From 75, right. Which we're talking an embarrassment of riches here. So Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here, Zeppelin's Physical Graffiti, Springsteen's Born to Run, Patti Smith's Horses, Neil Young's Tonight's Tonight, and Zuma, the bands that Basement Tapes.
Tonight's Tonight, right? Tonight's Tonight recorded a few years earlier, right, though, Getz?
Recording Tonight's Tonight? I couldn't say offhand.
I think so, because I think it's on the heels of Danny Whitten's death, I think is when he recorded that. Yeah. So Tonight's Tonight was released in 75, but I think a lot of it was recorded a couple of years before. Anyway.
Sure. Neil Young delaying the release of music? I've never heard of such a thing. It's just sitting on music? All of these obvious
two Rush records from that year. Two Rush records.
It's unbelievable. Just an embarrassment of riches. And so I'm thinking, okay, which way do I want to go in researching 1975? It's like, well, I've heard all these albums dozens and dozens of times. And there's some lesser known albums for me, at least, that I could dig into. But what I decided to listen to, because of the album cover, caught my eye, and I recognize it, but I never listened to it, and that was Neu, the West German krautrock band Neu. And they released their third album, I believe, Neu 75. And I went down a rabbit hole of krautrock, which for those not familiar, like I wasn't familiar about 10 days ago, but it's been my whole personality since.
Betsy's glad though that at least you got into kraut rock than homemade sauerkraut.
That's next. Like if I really want to immerse better. Myself. Yeah. Yes, it does. Krautrock is this kind of psychedelic experimental music that came out of West Germany in the late 60s, early 70s, and includes album or bands that you might recognize like Can and Tangerine Dream and Kraftwerk to an extent, and Popova and Harmonia and Faust the songs are driven by what's called a motoric beat. And I was most familiar with a motoric beat from Wilco's A Ghost Is Born album. They have a song on there called Spiders, parentheses, Kid Smoke. And this song live just absolutely burns. It's so great. And I didn't realize that is a motoric beat. It's totally based on krautrock. And here I am watching this documentary by on the Noisy YouTube channel about Krautrock, and I'm thinking, oh, you know what? It reminds me of Spiders, Wilco's Spiders Kid Smoke. And I kid you not, 1 minute later, there is Jeff Tweedy talking about Spiders Kid Smoke and how it was influenced by the Motorhead beat, also known as the Apache beat. And so I felt vindicated in like starting to connect these dots. And yeah, don't get me wrong, I've listened to tons of music, but I have a lot of blind spots in my listening, and I'm not afraid to admit it. And Krautrock was one of those. And so it's so fun when you can like connect the dots on things, especially when we're researching for this podcast. And I go down these rabbit holes that I otherwise probably wouldn't have gone down. Like, who knows when I finally listen to Noi. What attracted me to it was that it's just so like driving and mesmerizing, this Motorhead beat and all these songs kind of bass. It's like an endless drum beat essentially. And so, but it's really kind of hopeful and inspiring, and it feels like it's like this perfect cruising music, just like cruise down the highway. And it just carries you further and further. And it ended up influencing like the Stooges. It influenced Yo La Tengo. It influenced Wilco. So it's like this whole, it spans the genres of its influence. And while I hadn't like heard these songs before, they were just like super familiar. And I think it's because of those artists. They would even incorporate the concrete ambient sounds into it. So it did get very psychedelic and avant-garde. And just hearing that though, it was you know, it's like hearing Muddy Waters for the first time and suddenly understanding where Led Zeppelin was coming from. And you're like, oh, of course. And for so often I've talked about how I first heard Television, the 70s band Television, and that made me understand Wilco so much better. In particular, for A Ghost Is Born and Sky Blue Sky era Wilco. But now that I've heard, dived into Noi and Krautrock, other and Can, and it's like, oh, that's the other big influence on those Wilco records, which is very satisfying. So I can't recommend it enough. Definitely check out Noi. They were my personal favorite out of all those bands, but Can was much more productive, I guess. Noi just has a few albums.
Yeah.
But Can is probably the most popular. So yeah, I don't know what your guys' experience with Krautrock before this, but I was very pleased to find it.
So yeah, coming from my like working at a record store background, I had obviously had dealt with some Krautrock, but I love the ones that you discovered. And then did you listen to the Harmonia one?
Yeah, Harmonia. I really
Harmonia
well.
Is a good one. Mm-hmm. They have the one that looks like a detergent bottle, I remember, for the album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there was a band called Jane that like we would sometimes get their stuff in. And I always dug it when I would put it on.
They are not on Apple Music. And so I don't know if it's all the streaming services that they aren't on, but hard to find Jane.
Huh. There you go. Another
good one of that genre too. Have you guys heard Ashra?
Okay.
Yeah.
They're pretty good.
Ashra Temple.
Ashra Temple.
Yeah. I've heard Ashra Temple. Yeah. That's
good. Yeah.
Their original album cover like opens up and has like I want to say hieroglyphics and stuff like on it.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah. A little bit of, I guess, would Agitation Free kind of be kind of like a Krautrock too? A little bit. Yeah. It's got the but anyway, you know, we're good stuff there. Good choice. No, it's not a genre I've explored that extensively. So I had seen this album cover before, Getz, and hadn't listened to it, you know, in a long time. So good
and
choice.
I recognize too that apparently that particular Noi album is somewhat controversial because Noi is comprised of two members, and for that album, one member did side A and then the other member did side B, and so I think that put some people off that there wasn't the collaboration going on. But I still enjoyed it thoroughly.
Nice. Yeah, and that stuff was so innovative, so influential And we don't even realize it all the time. You know, another big influence on Wilco, right, in addition to krautrock, is country music. And 1975, you know, is also like peak country gold, too. Now, Levi, I know that one of your picks. Well, you want to get into that, because I think it's such a great record that you selected there for like kind of the country pick.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, to some people, this may be like a 1975 sleeper kind of classic, but it's one of the best honky tonk records ever recorded, and that's Gary Stewart's "Out of Hand" from 1975. Gary Stewart, we've talked about on the podcast, but to kind of just surmise it, he brought an electrifying mix of country, southern rock, barroom heartbreak, and this album is pretty much his masterpiece. You know, to zhuzh it up some, we would say this is the sound of neon signs, broken relationships, and last call emotions. His voice is high, trembly, full of intensity, and once you hear it, you never forget it. The album's big hit, "She's Acting Single and I'm Drinking Double," went to number one on the country charts and is basically the template for 70s honky-tonk heartbreak songs.
And is also one of the best song titles of all time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But what makes Gary Stewart special is his edge. His records always had more swagger, more grit than anything country music was cranking out of Nashville at the time. You can hear touches of southern rock, and in the guitars, you can hear the influence of Merle Haggard in the storytelling. But Stewart is always unmistakably his own thing, raw, emotional, and always on the verge of unraveling. Songs like "Drinking Thing" and "Out of Hand" hit like that perfect mix of vulnerability and danger that he was so good at. He sings like a guy who's been there and barely made it out. And in 1975, when outlaw country was exploding with Willie, Waylon, Gary Stewart carved out his own corner of the scene. It was honky-tonk for people who lived hard and felt deeply. And so, yeah, that's definitely the one I think is my favorite country record of 1975.
Yeah, such a great right LP.
On. Right on. Yeah, covers Gary Jeff Walker's "Backsliders Wine" on there.
Oh, yeah, great version of it too, man.
Yeah.
I
mean, there's almost as many good country records as there are rock records of 1975. You know, I mean, it's pretty endless from that genre too.
Yeah.
Waylon's "Dream in My Dreams."
Oh yeah, classic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Terry Allen's "Juarez" is from 75.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's so many.
Chinga Shaolin's "Number One."
What's that?
No, there's an album that came out in 1975 called Chinga Shaolin's "Country Porn," and he was a comedian who hung out, and he was from Texas, and was in all those same circles of all those outlaw country musician guys, and he would write all these crazy underrated, like underground, I mean, comedy, like X-rated outlaw country songs, like "Cum Stains on My Pillow," and he wrote, I think he's the guy who wrote "The Lasso from El Paso," which one of his best friends was Kinky Freeman, who Kinky Freeman had a hit with.
There you go.
That
album you could only buy in the back of like Playboys and Penthouses or like at head shops. Because it has a naked woman, like nude and like a cowboy hat on her head, like her head tilted down. Yeah, it was like an avant-garde country underground record back then.
Yeah.
I wasn't even going to mention that, but you just made me think of it. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, David Allan Coe, "Once Upon a Rhyme," you know, came out that year. That one stands out. You mentioned, right, "Old Number One," Gary Guy Clark.
Oh, yeah, great album that year.
"Dream in My Dreams," you know, Waylon is pretty much the biggest thing going in country music. And obviously, you know, it's a strong time for women in country as well. I know, Getz, you had your eye on one LP, right? From
Emmylou Harris released two records that year.
Yes, two records that year. Yeah. So, and there was, you know, a lot of buzz. Like, she's got a ton of people playing on both of those records. Oh shit, dude, Rhinestone Campbell, Glenn Campbell came out, or Rhinestone Cowboy, Glenn Campbell came out that year too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amy Lou with two records. Gosh, man.
That Waylon record finishes with Bob Wills Is Still the King, which has one of my favorite lines, I think of all time, on that, in that song, which is, it don't matter who's in Austin, Bob Wills is still the king.
Still the king. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the quintessential Waylon records and country records of that era. Gosh, there's so many good ones here too. Yeah. Good. It's just a great time for country music as well. Yeah. Gosh, what else? I might even miss. Yeah. So Redhead Stranger, I think we mentioned as well, came out that year. So just a glorious time for that. You know, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, it was a very, you know, we talked about Prague at the beginning of this episode and how kind of was very experimental rock and roll, and even with krautrock, like you said, Getz. And, you know, this was a really good time to kind of do what you wanted as a jazz artist too in 1975, right? I mean, they're obviously, like, fusion jazz kind of, you know, like, you know, what Bitches Brew kind of made the template for would kind of define jazz, you know, for the next 10 years, right? And all of those guys, you know, that played on that record all had their successful projects, or, you know, people that played with people, you know. The record that I kind of honed in on from jazz for that year is Grover Washington Jr.'s Mr. Magic. It's a really good record. I mean, it's to me, it kind of is sort of the kind of the bridge between some of that earlier fusion stuff with, like, Return to Forever and Weather Report and Mahavishnu. And then it's kind of like the bridge where it's got some of that, but it also has a little bit more of kind of the smoother, not totally smooth jazz, but, like, the smoother sound that, like, you would see, like, on, like, George Benson's record, Breezin, the next year, or, you know, some of the stuff by, like, Al Di Meola, you know. It's kind of like a middle ground, you know what I mean, between those two, as kind of like the more experimental side of fusion, and then kind of the slicker side of fusion, which would kind of explode more in the 80s, you know, for better or worse. But yeah, I really like this record. It's such a great listen. It's only four tunes, you know, so they're definitely, like, long jazz compositions. It's a great album cover. It's got a very earthy kind of sound to it as well. And it also, you know, charted really well. Like, I mean, it made the top 10, not like of the jazz charts. It was number one on the jazz charts. It was a top 10 pop album.
It was a crossover for sure.
People were just so into music that just was so experimental and out there and took chances. Like, I mean, it was commercially successful too.
Yeah, I think the public audience seemed like they were way more open to the fact that, like, good tunes were good tunes. It didn't matter. Yeah. And that label, Kudu, that album is on, is a subsidiary of CTI, which is Creed Taylor, and famous jazz producer. And anything I've ever come across on Kudu, I snag, because it's always usually excellent. So, I recommend anything. If you come across on that label, you'll probably...
Nice. Yeah, I'll dig into the label, too. But, yeah, that one stood out to me. You know, I mean, I've got, like, a big mix I've made over the last, like, probably, like, 10 years of, like, just 70s jazz, mostly fusion, you know, dominant form in that genre. And that one came out. So I was looking for something, looking through it for this episode. And, yeah, that one stood out to me. That's one I've always kind of gone back to. I really, really like Mr. Magic a lot. So it's a very, very, very cool time for jazz music. Yeah, that's another pick of mine. Um, Guys, we could chat a few kind of rock records now as well.
Yeah, I got one. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to talk a little bit about Jefferson Starship's Red Octopus.
Yeah.
And in 1975, that was a pretty big transition year for the former Jefferson Airplane family. And Red Octopus became the commercial peak of Jefferson Starship. You know, this wasn't psychedelic rock anymore. This was polished, soulful, radio-ready California rock. Yeah. And it worked. It went double platinum. It hit number one. It ended up being the most commercially successful record in the entire Jefferson umbrella. The heart of the album, of course, is Marty Balin. His return to the group gave them a whole new emotional center within the band. Miracles, his 6-minute masterclass in smooth romantic soft rock, is hypnotic, kind of that song is almost kind of like a template for that other era of smooth jazz of the 80s. What was that called? Like not Gentle Rain, but there's like a whole subgenre of smooth 80s jazz that kind of sounds like Miracles by
painting with watercolors.
But one of the secret weapons of the record is Papa John Creech, which we've talked a little bit maybe I think before. Creech was a veteran blues jazz violinist before he ever got into the Airplane Hot Tuna Starship world, which he played with all three of them at some point. Having like a legit like swing rooted violin in the band was different, you know what I mean, to have somebody like trying to cut over all of the rock solos. It kind of gave it a rootsy swagger that helped soften some of the rock edges. Then you have Craig Chiquico, who was barely in his 20s. He had great guitar lines to go along with the aging Paul Kantner. Gray Slick still had a good voice at that time as well. You know, in a year when a lot of 1960s acts were still struggling to evolve, they were able to kind of pull off a reinvention within the 70s, which a lot of bands weren't able to pull off reinventions till the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was kind of neat for them.
Yes, the airplane becomes the Starship. Right. Yeah. That is crazy. That album went to number one too. You know,
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah, yeah. It sold a ton of copies.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I guess you've got a choice on here that I wanted to hear more about. Obviously, hats off to this choice. Wah, wah.
Hold on.
Yeah. So,
Roy Harper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and Roy Harper was another instance of a musician that is like, I've always seen this name. Of course, on Led Zeppelin 3, I've seen this name, but I've never actually like spun a Roy Harper record. So he was another blind spot that, I really enjoyed this record, HQ, he released in 75. And, I mean, it starts off with this like 13-minute track that features David Gilmour and John Paul Jones. So that's
he kept cool. Good company.
Yep. Oddly enough, the album in the U.S. was titled "When an Old Cricketer Leaves the Crease." Which why would the U.S. version reference cricket? Yeah, I don't know why. That doesn't make any sense. So Roy Harper, I mean, extremely prolific. Got rolling in the mid '60s. And was releasing albums pretty regularly deep into the 80s and 90s. HQ is definitely worth a listen. I think it's going to, you know, kind of open the door for me for Roy Harper, Roy Harper's other albums. How familiar were you guys with Roy?
I think I'm confused for a second. He wasn't in ELO, right? Is there another guy who named Roy?
It's a guy named Roy Wood at ELO.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Too many Roys. No, I I had heard some of him before, you know, with my record store days.
Folk rock,
right? Yeah,
prog a bit, and yeah.
He never got his due. Like, he seemed to like be one of those people that was always like a musician's musician. I would hear him mentioned lots of other British musicians. Like, you would read interviews with other British musicians, and they would always mention Roy Harper.
Yep. And he's still with us, by the way. That's good. 84 years young.
Yeah. I mean, I saw the name, you know, like in high school because of Led Zeppelin 3, you know, like you there. But I only really started listening to him, you know, really with this podcast, because we did an episode a few years back where I focused on Fairport Convention. For, you know, I inducted him, I think, into the Chew-Ins. And, you know, his playing is, he gets lumped into that kind of Brit folk genre, you know, a little bit. His playing's a little jazzier than some of those cats. But yeah, you know, I would hear him mentioned, you know, alongside Fairport Convention, Richard Thompson, Steel Eye Span, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, I get the accolades. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I'm excited to dive deeper, and I recommend others do the same.
Yeah. You know, there were a couple, any others you guys want to touch on here? I know we could talk.
I have one I can do pretty quick. Yeah. That can be my last one. But I did want to mention this one, and it's an album that I remember, you know, seeing this album a lot, like in my record digging days, and I never really picked it up until maybe the last 5 or 6 years ago. And it's 10cc, the original soundtrack. And this album specifically is kind of the album where 10cc fully leaned into their identity as like studio crap scientists, kind of like Steely Dan type. Of production. And so it's best known for the hit "I'm Not in Love," which was on the radio a ton in 1975. And I would, you know, it's got to be one of the greatest soft rock productions ever created, but the whole album itself is like a masterclass in art pop and like studio invention and like British satire, which like sums up the whole band's career basically. But let's start with the hit, "I'm Not in Love." It took 3 weeks of overdubbing to build the song. They created an actual choir of themselves, like multiple tracks of themselves just going, and they arranged it like an organ and fed it through a mixing console and arranged it out like notes on the faders, like a mellotron. So they could play these like vocals, and the result is like this dreamy, weightless sound that song has that like no other song at the time ever had. It sounded like nothing ever had before.
Sure.
And the lyrics are pure 10cc, dry humor wrapped in genuine emotion. But the album is much more than that. The opening title track, pardon my French here, "Une Nuit à Paris," is this 9-minute multi-part mini opera that basically predicted Bohemian Rhapsody. You get like vaudeville influences, cinematic flourishes, sound effects, chord changes all over the place. They were one of those like playful, clever British bands, kind of like Supertramp a little bit, maybe. But what made them unique in 1975 was kind of how self-aware and witty they were with it. You know, while other bands of, you know, their peers were kind of dealing with like big emotions and grand statements, and they were kind of always like winking at the audience while still delivering like their pop craftsmanship. So yeah, I always like that, and I would say it's like one of the smartest albums of 1975.
Nice. And, you know, predicting Bohemian Rhapsody, Night at the Opera came out in 75 as well, right?
Right.
Yeah. Even yeah. moved from yeah. that. Yeah. Again, so much ground to cover, you know, and I'll try to put a bow on it here a little bit. Guess we covered all yours, right? I think, did we?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
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 You know, I'll say this because she's in town tonight and tomorrow night, and she's performing this record in its entirety. Whatever I could say would not do how good it is justice, but Patti Smith's Horses, right? You know, nothing like that had ever been made before,
no.
right? I mean, I know that's one of those albums that, like, music critics pretty much start masturbating on the spot when you mention it, that record. But, you know, it's hats off to Patti. You know, she's a badass, and it she earned every accolade she ever receives, you know, for that record, and then, you know, some of the rest of her catalog as well. But, you know, just that was, I wasn't cool enough to listen to that in high school, you know, or even college. Came to me later, you know, probably when I was in like my mid 20s, I picked it up really for the first time. I always knew she was cool. Always knew she was respected and groundbreaking, but, yeah. Horses is just something else entirely.
Oh, yeah.
So what are your guys' picks for just like the super popular stuff? What's your go-to album? Like, mine is Physical Graffiti. That's my favorite Zeppelin album.
Okay.
I just can't get enough of it. And it's just absolutely drenched with great rock and roll. So what are you guys picking up if you're going for one of the albums?
Wish you were here, probably.
We're talking like of the big LPs? Yeah.
Yeah, the big ones. The big ones.
Poison in the Attic, Wish You Were Here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I would
Young Americans.
Yeah, they're fucking forgot about that one. Yeah. I like the ones Levi just mentioned, and you guys, you know,
we didn't mention in the country portion, but Redheaded Stranger was in 70.
Oh, yeah, just briefly, yeah,
like monumental country music album.
Yeah. Tonight is always hold a.
Zuma,
a place in the heart. Yeah, and Zuma.
I don't mind a minstrel in the gallery either, you know.
One of the other ones I was going to talk about extended more was That's the Way of the World, Earth, Wind, and Fire. That album still holds up as probably their best album.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like always kind of considered the Steely Dan of soul and funk because, if you listen to those records, man, there's some studio wizardry and musicianship and all kinds of stuff going on.
Sure.
I'll go with Fly By Night.
That's my pick. And then I'll also take this opportunity to reference a band that I referenced before in our Bay Area episode, and that is the Pointer Sisters. They released an album called Steppin' in 75.
Yeah.
That is unbelievable. If you need to be convinced, put on the last tune from Steppin' and they'll win you over.
Good stuff. Gosh, just such a great time. Well, anyway, we had a great time hanging out with you tonight. We hope to do this much more frequently in the upcoming year. Thanks for tuning in. You can follow us on Instagram at RockInChew. That's in for, did Nazareth come out with a record in 1975? I'm
Hair
not
of the
sure.
Dog, baby.
Did Hair of the Dog come out in 75?
No, yo, Bastard with them.
Yeah, buddy. See, the list goes on and on. I just kind of assume Nazareth came out with a record that year. I don't know. It was like their best one.
Right? It's in your genes. You were born knowing that album came out in 1975.
Yes. Great stuff all around. Follow us on Rock In Chew. You can find all of our episodes on rockchew.com. We're also available on your favorite podcasting apps, including Spotify. So,
give us some stars. Give us some stars. Give us a review.
Please do. And you know, we always try, you know, to create, you know, we're kind of in the nostalgia business around here, you know, mostly, you know, not entirely, but we'll dust off some other episodes too, because I think there's some stuff from previous ones we can kind of glean and share too, you know, that make for fun lists and whatnot. So it was good talking to you fellas again, and hope everybody has a great night. Really enjoy talking about 1975. Take care. Yeah.